you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Well, week 10, a little bit rocky. Week 11, got back on track for a lot of the quote-unquote contending teams. The Eagles, the Ravens, the Bills, the Bengals, the Chiefs. All got wins, some stronger than others, but they all survived week 11 to move on to Thanksgiving week. Hell of a bounce back week for a lot of the upper echelon of the NFL. But most importantly, week 11 is a reckoning for me personally, because I am a man of my word. And on our Thursday stream, roughly 4 or 5 days ago, during the Packers-Titans game, which we will kind of talk about even more in depth, I was paid not once, not twice, not thrice, but four times to do a shot of absinthe on this week's podcast. So I'm not going to do them back to back because I really enjoy living.
Yeah.
But I will start this week's show with my first of four absinthe shots. This is Oregon Spirit, by the way. It is what, like 125
proof? Or what the Irish would call 62 and a half horsepower. I ended up with the same one, and it is the acronym is NFA, not futzing around.
Yeah. So to you, our lovely bootleg audience, for making me do horrific things to my body on a Monday at 10:30 in the morning.
Yeah, I'll be joining in later in the show, but that's why I'm not kicking off the show that way, in case you were wondering.
Oh, that's death.
Yeah, it's rugged. We'll have some fun with that later on, but Jay, for now, just run the logo.
Please. All right, we're covered a little bit. Let's get into the show. We're going to start off with news and notes. We don't really have any news and notes other than just the fact that I was on the road and filming all day yesterday. I went up to Chiefs Chargers, saw that Sunday night game live, which was an incredible Sunday game, by the way, that we are going to talk about in depth. So as a result, I didn't get to watch too many games. I was able to do a lot of film study when I got home, and then obviously this morning catching up on stuff. So we're doing a little bit of a modified format. Because I didn't get to see every game. We're doing a 3-up, a 2-down, and a 1-fun instead of a 3-3-3. So we're cutting it down a little bit because we have a policy here that we don't talk in depth about games that we don't watch. So we're maintaining that sole focus of not blowing smoke up your ass. So we're going to start off with 3-fun, then 2-down. Or no, 3-up, 2-down, 1-fun. Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah, I'm one for the absinthe.
I can already feel it. It's
Did you do the carb loading?
Oh, I had like double breakfast because I was like, I need as many bagels in me as possible to survive.
Strong work. So strong work.
Well, we're gonna start off the show by going over the game where we were paid to do this, which was our Thursday stream last Thursday, Titans Packers. Now that we've had a chance to kind of go back and look at the film and kind of evaluate and get a new perspective on what happened. And also, going forward, what this means for the Titans and the Packers for the rest of the year. You know, honestly, the Packers, when I watched that game on film, I was like, this team is not as bad as their record. They just didn't figure out what they are soon enough in the season. They are a little bit of a one-dimensional team, but I do think that hell, if Christian Watson doesn't drop that first throw of the year, that first bomb, and lose trust from Aaron for like the first 5 weeks, and you know, obviously he had the injuries too, but if he doesn't drop that bomb and Aaron kind of like trusts him a little bit earlier in the year, who knows where this Packers team is. Like, he obviously is a difference maker for that passing game. And when you're going up against a D-line like the Titans that can really stop the run and limit Aaron Jones, you need a guy like Christian Watson that can kind of take over a game like what happened against Dallas. So I almost feel like it's a little, this term might not be correct for it, but it's the closest one I can think of, like too little too late. Like, would they have been a great team otherwise? Maybe, but they definitely would not have been wallowing in misery for a large portion of the middle of the season if they got Christian Watson more involved from the very beginning, or at least committed to getting through the drops as growing pains earlier. Because again, this is the same team that beat the Cowboys, who just obliterated the Vikings. Like, they have that in them. They just didn't get to it quick enough. And then on the other side, the Titans, I mean, God, how can you not look at Vrabel as a top five coach in the NFL? All of their injuries, you know, limitations on offense, you know, whether you want to look at the receiving core, like there was a while where we're like, God, they miss AJ Brown, but you know, eventually Treylon Burks kind of had his breakout game, but again, took a while to get there. You know, limitations at the quarterback position when Tannehill was out, like Malik Willis clearly wasn't ready. You know, obviously all the injuries on defense, and yet they're still ripping off wins when there's so many excuses for them to not win ball games, like short week on the road in the snow, still winning. And I think that Mike Vrabel is an absolutely elite NFL coach, because I think a lesser coach would have folded given their circumstances this year and some of the durability concerns they've had. And yet they're probably going to be like a two or a three seed when all is said and done. And they're going to be the type of two or three seed that nobody wants to play because they got a great defensive line. They can run the ball. And if Treylon Burks keeps doing some of the things we saw him do on Thursday, that big playability, that kind of replaces the dynamism that they lost with A.J. Brown, which reared its ugly head a few weeks ago. So, like, this is a team that has not even been fully operational for the entire season, and they're still well positioned for the playoffs. Once they actually get healthy again, who knows how far they could go. But, you know, that's kind of my general takeaway from this game, is a little too late, a little too little too late for the Packers, and the Titans are just a phenomenally solid organization from top to bottom.
I think Vrabel likes it this way. I really do.
Hard?
I think he,
difficult?
Yeah. I think he likes taking a group of football players that he believes in, all of them, top to bottom, not just the ones in the first string, and saying, if you do it my way, if you play together, if you play physical, we're going to win. Like, we're not going to win them all, but we're going to win enough. And they just keep doing that. This is not the first year he's done it. This is the first year with this particular construction, because each year is a different year in the NFL. Teams have so much turnover in the offseason that you do really start fresh each year. But Vrabel approaches it in the same way. And even without those things, their defensive line is leading them. Packers, a very good rushing team. They end up with like 56 rushing yards as a team.
Yeah.
You know, Aaron Jones, who we think is a superstar, has 40. Dylan, 13. Christian Watson for 3 on that one sweep. That's, you can make a team, force a team out of the thing that they do well at home. Like you said, for the Titans, it's on the road. They go in and pull that off. That sets a tone. They play extremely physical. They've been showing up on Shot of the Week all year. And then they get, strangely enough, 1 week later, their big rookie wide receiver breakout that they'd been waiting for, because moving on from A.J. Brown, they really expected things from Treylon Burks. He waited until a week after Christian Watson had hit his explosion to have, you know, Burks' own explosion, 7 for 111, 15.9 per. Didn't get in the end zone, but didn't matter. Really was a spark for them in the exact same way. It was like a mirror image a week later. So Titans, I think Vrabel just thinks this is the plan. He's seen it work enough. He has them believing they are playing. They, you know, they didn't throw in the towel and say, well, no more A.J. Brown, I guess we're done. Or Treylon Burks hasn't popped off yet, I guess we're done. They just keep doing it, keep rolling off wins, and they are one of those teams. They feel a little bit like Kansas City to me in that way, not in the way that their offense is built at all, but really just until further notice, the Titans are going to own this division because Vrabel's there and he's going to do this and it works. And it's the same way with Kansas City. It's like Andy Reid's there and they do it their way and it works. And until further notice or Patrick Mahomes ascends to the next plane of existence, they got it. It's theirs. They own it.
I would say Vrabel, if he's not your pick for coach of the year, he better at least be in your top three at this point. Because, I mean, for God's sake, they took Kansas City to overtime with like pretty much no passing game to speak of. And that was just purely with a couple explosives from Derrick Henry, some creative play calling in the red zone. They really love their trick plays, just like Kansas City. And their defense is utterly insane. They had a great game plan against Kansas City, one that very few teams have been able to pull off. Like, I don't know. Mike Vrabel, to me, will they end up being the best team? No. But in terms of doing more with less, it's hard to argue that Mike Vrabel has not done the most with the least. Either him or Brian Daboll, I would say, are the two that fit in that category. Not that the Titans roster isn't talented, but they've just been so hurt all year long, and they're still winning games. In terms of the prize pick slip, though, I did have a lot of success there. I hit a 4 out of 5 and a 5 out of 6, so I came up plus $80 on the evening. You can see on my original slip when I did the 5 pick, I did Aaron Rodgers over 1.5 passing TDs. At home on Thursday, snow falling, I felt like, yeah, that feels like an Aaron Rodgers decent kind of night. And it was. Aaron Rodgers was not bad. He was not the problem in this game. So he got me there. Aaron Jones, I thought because of the Titans' defensive structure in terms of how much quarters they play, it would invite a lot of gives to Aaron Jones. And I came about 2 carries short there. I needed him to get to 14. He had 12. So, you know, maybe if they didn't fall so far behind, I could have got a couple extra there and hit 5 out of 5 and won like $500 on this slip. So I think the thinking was sound. It just fell a couple carries short. Alan Lazard hit my over begrudgingly. There's a couple times where I was like, Alan, you really don't want to get targeted ever again, because he had the drops and the missed routes and everything like that. He had a really rough night, but he still hit the over on yardage. His over under was 48.5. I took the under on Christian Watson targets. Not that I didn't think he wouldn't have a productive night, but I felt like it was more going to be, you know, throw a couple bombs here and there and kind of leave the possession stuff to everybody else. That ended up being proven true. I had under 6.5 targets. He had 6. And then I had Derrick Henry over 1.5 touchdown. So basically I had him scoring a rushing touchdown, because what primetime game would it be with the Titans without Derrick Henry scoring? So hit 4 out of 5 on that, narrowly missed 5 out of 5. And what would have been in total between my two slips, a $700 payout. I just needed a couple extra carries, but I still feel pretty good about it. And then we got a whole Thanksgiving slate of slips this Thanksgiving as well. So I'm going to be, you know, kind of tweeting out my methodologies for those. We don't have a stream this Thursday, but we will be filling out slips. And if you also want to fill out slips, by the way, you can get a free Thanksgiving square for all the Thanksgiving games. If you want to fill out just a Thursday slip, Justin Jefferson's receiving yard, they set it at over under 0.5 yards. So as long as he gets 1 yard, which will probably be on like the first play of the game because he's Justin Jefferson, you get a free square there. And then obviously you still get the deposit match. Whatever deposit you make up to $100, they will match your deposit. So you get a whole bunch of free money to play with on the platform as well. So get your free Justin Jefferson square, get your deposit match, go have yourself a very nice Thanksgiving this Thursday. EJ, what say you?
It'll let you concentrate on football. Even if you don't want to be with whatever section of the family you're with, you can be counting on the counting on the games, looking to see if you're polishing off the lines. Alan Lazard kept you waiting until late in the game. Keeps it a little bit interesting down the stretch when guys are doing that, but we also filled out their new 6-pick flex slip, which pays up to 25 times on Thursday. That was our debut with that, and you came real close to hitting that one as well. So lots of options, certainly helps the show, sign up for Prize Pick, get your money matched up to $100, get the free Justin Jefferson square, because there's probably not a freer square in the NFL right now than Justin Jefferson getting over a yard of receiving. So he's all good there. Happy to have Prize Picks on as a sponsor. Happy to have you all enjoying it. And you'll see our slips for these Thursday games coming out on social media.
Now, they do play against the Patriots, by the way, which the Vikings do, which lead in man coverage this year. So if there's one guy you don't want to leave one-on-one in man, it's probably Jefferson. Just saying.
Probably. Just saying.
All right. Why don't we finally get up to three up? Okay. Three up.
Oh, sell the sizzle, man. Sell the sizzle.
Woo! Three up. Chargers Chiefs. EJ, I'm going to let you talk first.
Yeah, it's weird that that's going to happen, but I'm happy to hold it up. So, Chiefs Chargers, you got to go to this game last night. Check it out. You also got to go to the tailgate beforehand. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But it's funny, during the afternoon slate yesterday, Seahawkers pod guys invited me on for a little Let It Ride Curse live stream. Seahawks are on a bye this week, so they were watching the Raiders-Broncos game, trying to encourage the curse for the Russell Wilson trade to continue itself. And during that live stream, I mentioned the fact, because Davante Adams gets free at the end of that game, and they're like, how do you not cover Davante Adams? I said, there's one guy like that in the AFC West for me, and it's Travis Kelce. Every time the Chiefs need something, whether it's a key third down conversion, it's a touchdown late, it's always Travis Kelce, and he's always open. And I'm like, how do you not cover Travis Kelce? Just like they were saying, how do you not cover Davante Adams? Then around comes the Sunday night game. Who wins the game for the Chiefs? Travis Kelce. He's basically Thanos on a football field. Thanos has that line in the movie. He says, dread it, run from it, destiny arrives all the same. And I feel like Travis Kelce is that destiny. You can try and cover him with a linebacker or a corner or even a super safety like Derwin James. It doesn't matter. They tried all of those things last night. He still got his receptions. He still got the game-winning TD. He's going to get those game-changing plays and TDs, even though everybody knows it's coming. And that is a testament to, obviously, Patrick Mahomes and Andy Reid's design. It's also a huge testament to Travis Kelce being one of the very best tight ends to ever play professional football, because everybody knows it's coming, and he can still get it done. He is inevitable. He was inevitable last night. He is a huge reason why Patrick Mahomes, and get this one kills me, has not lost a divisional road game
ever.
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 Like, not in a year, not in 2 years. From the first one he ever started, he's never lost an AFC West road game. Mm-hmm. That's staggering.
And we're on season six of this, by the way.
Yeah, he's 14 and 0. Right? And last night, I think, makes 15.
Or maybe it's 14. Last night was 14.
Last night's 14.
The Denver one, his rookie year, his first start was also on the road in Denver, and he still won that game, too. So
every time somebody says, oh, this guy's like Mahomes, especially in the upcoming draft cycle. I put out a tweet yesterday, said, in the upcoming draft cycle, spare me. Don't ever say, might be the next Mahomes. Ain't going to happen. 14-0 has never lost a divisional road game. So part of that success definitely comes from Travis Kelce and his greatness and his ability to get open no matter what the other team does.
There's very few quarterbacks that have come out since Mahomes has been in the league that I felt comfortable comparing to Mahomes, because it's not like there's arm talent comparisons. Like Caleb Williams at USC is a great arm talent and kind of like arm slot comparison in terms of some of the stuff he can do that way. Like there's physical comparisons, and then there's the stuff that actually makes Mahomes, which is like the off schedule shit, the serial killer stuff. One of the only ones I've ever felt comfortable comparing to Mahomes as a prospect was Joe Burrow. When Joe Burrow was coming out of LSU, I made a video that year. It's like, Burrow's the next Mahomes. It's not an arm talent thing. It's not a physical makeup thing. It's the fact that like, he will rip your heart out. It doesn't matter. He will rip your heart out. That's what they do. That's what these types of quarterbacks do. And Mahomes, I mean, that was the first time I've ever seen him with my own eyes. And it just felt inevitable. And, like, that stadium was loud. Like, obviously, there's a lot of Chiefs fans there because there's always Chiefs fans everywhere. They're a massive fan base. But, like, there's a lot of Chargers fans there, too. And they were jazzed up and excited because Chiefs-Chargers is always a great game. Like, there was a shitload of Chargers fans there. And they were loud. And it just felt like there was nothing anybody could do about it. It felt like that was the script and everybody was following the script. Like, oh, Mahomes going to get the ball back down late, you know, 2 minutes to go. And then it's going to be him and Kelsey just magically scoring. And I love watching Chiefs Chargers because it always ends up like that. But if I was a Chargers fan at this point, I would have Stockholm syndrome. Cause I'm like, I don't know what to do against this guy. It doesn't matter what we do against this guy. He's gonna beat us every time. And it's remarkable. It's frightening. It's exciting. And I can't wait to go again next year.
I know exactly what that's like.
You? Oh, because Aaron Rodgers, yeah, Chicago. You just know it's coming. Yeah.
You know it's coming, and it feels the same way to me when I watch those games. Obviously, I have less of an emotional stake, but you don't ever think that Mahomes is going to lose that game. I was actually surprised to see it tied late in the game, or, you know, close late in the game. I was like, really? And I was like, eh, doesn't matter. Like, I could not watch this. I'd come back tomorrow and I wouldn't be at all surprised to see the result, which is the result we got. It does feel like it is always going to happen. Everybody knows it's going to happen, and it happens anyways.
Another little note I have, Isaiah Pacheco, 100% is the guy. Like, it's not a, you know, a 50-50 split thing. Like, Isaiah Pacheco is RB1 by a lot in Kansas City. And I say this as somebody who loved Clyde coming out of LSU. Clyde, for whatever reason, whether it's durability or, you know, anything like that, has not lived up to his draft status and even hasn't lived up to our great, like, he was one of our favorite players in that whole class. He was one of a lot of people's favorite players in that whole class. Everybody loved Clyde at LSU. But then you get to the NFL where draft status doesn't really matter anymore and you got this, you know, 215-pound, 4'3", lightning bolt named Isaiah Pacheco in the seventh round, who, when he gets on the field, you can tell physically there is a difference. Like, the juice is there. The want-to is there. Like, he runs every single time he gets the ball. Like, he runs like it's his last time on the field. Like, he is a violent, physical, explosive runner. And from a schematic perspective, for a lot of the stuff that Kansas City likes to do, which is they like to call outside zone from the gun. You could hate that approach or not because the angles are all fucky and I'm not a big outside zone fan from that particular track, but they like to do it and they like to call counter and you know, everything they like to do from shotgun, which is we're going to do our best to get the running back to the edge or create a big ass seam on counter. Isaiah Pacheco is perfectly suited for that. And when you combine his explosiveness and physicality with the fact that the Chargers straight up cannot fit the run. Like, there was a couple runs last night on counter where, like, you had Kenneth Murray flying downhill and the edge read it correctly. Like, they ran two pullers at the edge and the edge is supposed to call it wrong shouldering. You go inside of it and spill it outside so you can get a 2-for-1 with the edge. And then the linebacker is supposed to overlap and take care of the running back when he bounces. Well, Kenneth Murray, being Kenneth Murray, just flew downhill and stuck his head inside the hole and got washed out. And then all of a sudden you have Derwin like one-on-one on the edge with the dude who runs 4-3 when he's like trying to cover Kelsey. And then he's like, oh shit, I gotta get out there. When that was supposed to be Kenneth Murray's job. And so it's like, it's not just the fact that their defensive line's getting blown off the ball. It's the fact their linebackers aren't fitting well. And sometimes I feel like it's like Drew Tranquil versus the world out there. Yeah. And it's just, it goes back to the offseason where we said, please don't let Kazir White go. And then they did. And we were worried this was going to happen. And it's happening. So there was a lot to take away from last night. Like, obviously, Kelsey, Mahomes, amazing. Pacheco, he's the dude. But God damn, the Chargers can't fit the run. And it's so hard to watch.
When teams can't do that, and this is part of the reason that because your White's new team, Philadelphia, just brought in two defensive linemen off the street this week, mm-hmm. and they played really well. And the Chargers need to do something similar. We talked about their inability. They went out and drafted a guy. There was a lot of talk that they were going to draft the same guy that the Eagles drafted for the mm-hmm. same reason. You got to have somebody in there, plug up the middle, eat space, run a gap and a half, two gaps, well, consistently all the time, or teams are going to take it if you give it to them. And it is sort of a lifeblood thing that just sustains drives and lets them move. If you can guarantee that you're going to get five or six on a run, you're going to be in short down and distance and everything else. The playbook just opens up. And the Chargers are not able to get out of their own way there. We thought that was a limitation of Murray's game coming out of college. We both called that he was physically a marvel, but in terms of discipline and vision, wasn't great and needed to develop. And he still has those moments where he goes off at 100 miles an hour, but he doesn't take the right angle. And it basically, just as you described it, takes himself out of the play, and you end up with a massive hole that the opposition exploits for a big gain, an easy first down, keeps a drive moving, and keeps your defense on the field. More downs, more reps, more tired, less ability to fit the run. It's sort of a nasty cycle once it gets going, and the Chargers don't seem to be able to get off that hamster wheel, and it's really frustrating. I know it is. I know some Chargers fans, and they moan about this regularly, and rightfully so.
Yeah, no, Pacheco led all running backs in rushing yards so far this week. We've still got the Monday night game to go as of the time of recording this, but I ran into a Chargers fan at the tailgate. By the way, shout out to Thunder Alley. Amazing tailgate scene there. Like, I've never been to a Chargers tailgate before. That was awesome. But I ran into a Chargers fan there who's a fan of the channel, and we chatted for a little bit. And he's like, you know, I took the Chargers to cover like 5.5. How do you think this game's going to go? I was like, I mean, maybe they'll cover, but I don't think they're going to win. This feels like a 20 carry, like 105 yard night from Pacheco because their run defense sucks. And he had 15 carries for 107. So I was close. I was pretty close on that. All right, let's get to three up number two. The Commanders, who, I'll tell you what, EJ, ever since the news came out a few weeks ago that Dan Snyder was selling, at least allegedly selling, kind of feels like the Commanders have taken on new life a little bit, almost like a curse was lifted. They ripped off a couple good wins in a row. They beat the Eagles, obviously, last week, and then they beat the Texans in convincing fashion this week. And they have a formula that is working, which is we will run the ball a lot. We got two backs we like. You know, Brian Robinson and Antonio Gibson are two different skill sets, but they like them both for different reasons. You know, we have a defense that can stuff the run. We still don't have Chase Young back in terms of helping out the pass rush, but we could stop the run. We can cover people. We got big playability every now and then from Terry if we need it, or, you know, this week it was Logan Thomas, or, you know, Curtis Samuel, whoever. Like, they pick one guy a week and say that's going to be the dude that gets 100 yards receiving. And then you got Taylor Heinicke, who, is he a great quarterback? No. Is he even a good quarterback? Struggle with that. Will he make the back-breaking, boneheaded mistakes that cost you games like Carson Wentz does? Also, no. I think he is a safer option for them than Carson Wentz, and I think as long as he's on the field for them and not making those back-breaking mistakes, and he just gives like two good balls to receiver of the week per game, let the run game and the defense do the rest, like, that is a formula that is working for them. They are in the chase for the playoffs right now, and they're in pretty decent position in terms of the chase for the playoffs right now. I kind of feel like I would stick with Heinicke, regardless of what's happening with Wentz and his broken thumb, I think it was. I kind of might stick with Heinicke because it's working, and I don't really want to disrupt the apple cart here.
Yeah, we talked about Mike Vrabel and his job helming Tennessee to their wins. We need to talk about Ron Rivera through, I would say, much choppier waters, keeping this team level. They're playing their second string QB in Taylor Heinicke and have been for a few weeks. They're down their star pass rusher in Young for basically the whole year. And they're a game out of second place in the most competitive division in football.
Mm-hmm.
They're the
eight seed right now.
That's remarkable. Mm-hmm. So the suffocating defensive line you talked about, they are incredibly stout. Damian Pierce, who we love, had 8 yards on 10 carries. Like, that's just absolutely smashing out the cigarette butt of a run game. Like, nah, you're going to have to do something else. We're not going anywhere. They're splitting that rushing attack fairly evenly between Gibson and Robinson. The efficiency is not the same, but in terms of the number of carries and the amount of times they use them and when they use them in the game, they really are very comfortable with that sort of two-headed back approach. And with Heinicke, like you said, his luck holds. Let's just put it that way. He throws up some stuff that a lot of other quarterbacks wouldn't get away with, but he does and he celebrates. And he doesn't, for the most part, make those back-breaking mistakes. He has stayed away from it. Has he flirted with them? 100%. Does he do it every week? He sure does. He is not the super safe game manager. He is the, it reminds me a little bit of Gardner Minshew, right? He'll throw it up and see if his guy can make a play. And for now, it's holding, and this is working in a very the most difficult division in football. So I'm with you. If you're rolling and the guy you had before that left the lineup due to injury has the occasional lightning bolt to the cover two hole down the sideline, but also can't make the 8-yard pass over the middle without throwing a horrendous pick, like, stay away from that and go with the guy that has a little bit, like, he's just that guy rolling dice in the alley right now. And you're like, no, don't keep going. And Taylor Heinicke's like, screw you, man. I'm absolutely keeping going. And it's been paying off for them week after week. So I would say ride the hot hand, because you don't get that much more with Wentz in terms of overall game. And you might even get less when you talk about addition by subtraction and taking away those really bad plays that for a while were taking the Commanders off track. Right now they are a train rolling down the track. They are in good position. If they can keep it up, they've got a shot to be a spoiler into the playoffs.
Oh, more than just a spoiler. They can literally, I mean, ruin the playoff picture. So right now they're the 8 seed, like I mentioned. They're 6-5. The 5 seed is the Cowboys at 7-3. They're probably going to make it, I would imagine. The 6 seed is the Giants, also at 7-3. They're pretty good position to make it. If you look at the Commanders' schedule, it's tough, but they got the Falcons this coming week. Is the 27th. So they got the Falcons, who are not a bad team, but absolutely able to beat them, because I think the Commanders are just a further along version of what the Falcons want to be. And so I think they can win that game. And then 5 of the next 6 games after that, you got the Giants twice in back-to-back games, because you got Giants, bye week, Giants. Then you got the 49ers, then you got the Browns, and then you got the Cowboys. So all three teams that are ahead of them in playoff seeding, if they go even 2-2 in that like last 5-week stretch, and you knock off one from the Giants and you knock off one from the 49ers, or even, you know, from the Cowboys, whoever, you're going to cause enough damage to make the playoffs there. So survive Atlanta and then go 2-2 in that last stretch against everybody else you're competing with, and the Commanders will be in the playoffs. And once they're in the playoffs, man, like a few years ago, we saw it, that the Taylor Heinicke-led Commanders, or no, they were the Washington football team at that point, but like, they gave Tom Brady everything they could handle before the Bucs won the playoffs. They actually, they played them tougher than the Chiefs did in the Super Bowl. So once they're in, they are not a team I would want to play against, because that particular formula of play defense, run the ball, and then just hope for, you know, the God-given luck of Taylor Heinicke. Like, that's the type of stuff that can ruin, you know, every playoff bracket that you've got going. So I think this is a storyline that people need to follow. Watch the Commanders the last 6 weeks, because if they go even 500 in that stretch, I think they're in. I really think they're in. All right, three up, number three, Bengals-Steelers. This was a fascinating game for a whole bunch of reasons. Number one, you know, you got TJ Watt back for Pittsburgh, which completely changes their defense. You are without Ja'Marr Chase, again, for the Bengals, which on paper completely changes their offense. You know, how would those two things kind of compound together? And could the Steelers steal a win here? And it was, you know, kind of back and forth. You had some great throws from Burrow. You had some really nice throws from Pickett. You had Samaje Perine getting, I think, what a hat trick.
A hat trick of receiving touchdowns.
Yeah, not even rushing, receiving.
Fantastic. That's just one of those throw the wild card in and see what happens. And Samaje Perine was the firecracker this week.
But it was a very, very entertaining game. And the Bengals held on. And they held on because they don't just have one number one receiver. They have two. And we could talk about this game in a vacuum, but I think there is something that we need to focus on temporarily, which is I don't know if they're going to be able to keep T. Higgins, because there's a lot of teams out there right now that would give him $25 million a year. And I don't know if the Bengals can afford to give Ja'Marr Chase 30-plus and T. Higgins 25-plus and Joe Burrow 50 million. Like, I don't know if there's any teams that can afford to do that. Like, T. Higgins is a legit number one receiver. He absolutely carried them in this game, 9 for, you know, basically $150, and then Samaje getting the touchdowns. But, like, this was a hard divisional game that the Bengals would have absolutely no shot of winning without T. Higgins being a legitimate number one caliber receiver. And I think Cincy fans should enjoy him while you got him, because God, he's going to be expensive when he's a free agent.
Yeah, he's expensive right now, and he should be. He has grown since he got in the league. He was good when he came in, but he was more of a straight number two boundary threat, jump up and go get it kind of a guy when he came in. That is not where he stopped. He has continued his growth. And yesterday was the clear number one. And on a team that was absent a guy like Ja'Marr Chase, he would be the number one, and easily so. He looked to hold that role down. The Steelers' secondary is good, not great. Their safeties are very good. Their corners, leave something to be desired. But T. Higgins made plays all over the field and at all levels and on all downs, didn't matter. Kind of like Kelce, not the same kind of attention, but they knew they needed to run their pass game through T. Higgins for the most part. Boyd was going to be there to support. Yeah, you're going to get some yards to your tight end as well, but it was really about, as T. Higgins goes, so Joe Burrow is going to go. Mm-hmm. And he delivered in spades. 9 catches, 148 yards, some real highlights in there, some real go up and get it hands grabs. He's going to go. I don't think that Cincinnati can throw as much money as they're going to need to throw at him to keep him. And all day yesterday when I was watching this game, all I could think of is, man, that guy'd look good in navy and orange, right? Yeah. Make him Justin's number one. And, you know, you just brought Claypool in, and I really think Claypool, speaking of the Steelers, would be a great number three in that offense coming out of the slot, because he could do some good things there and then run Mooney as the sort of number two like Lockett, and that would be a really good receiving core. And the Bears aren't the only one. Bears have the most money, but there are going to be suitors lined up around the block for T. Higgins, and it is going to be very tough for the Bengals to say, we're going to give you the most money. You might want to keep playing with Joe, and that's a card in our pocket, but in terms of who's going to give you the most lucrative deal, it's very unlikely to be the Bengals, knowing that Ja'Marr Chase's contract is looming.
Yeah, it's not even the Bengals don't want to keep him. They absolutely want to keep him.
100%.
The fans want to keep Higgins, but I think it's going to be the same thing that happened to Jesse Bates. Like, there's a long valley between what we want and what we can do, and I don't know of any NFL franchise that's putting, like, in terms of guaranteed dollars, God, probably that almost $500 million combined by the time all these contracts are done between Burrow and Chase. And like, they're not going to do that. Nobody's going to do that. So they're going to probably trade him, I would imagine, for a first round pick, because that's what they would get for him. And I think that they would say, okay, we'll take this first round pick and we'll try to go get, you know, another guy that's cheaper to be the new quote unquote number two to Ja'Marr. But like, from a team building standpoint, Ain't no way they're going to try to keep it. Like, if they do, that would be such a colossal shift in approach for what Cincinnati's always been. I would be like, okay, who is wearing Mike Brown's skin right now? Because that's not him. It would just be a complete departure of how they build their football team. So again, it's not a is T. Higgins good question. He's absolutely good. It's, oh my God, can we afford this? And I don't know if they can. On the flip side, I do want to give one little note about Kenny Pickett. Even though they lost the game, I think there were some throws in this game that signaled Steelers got something here. Mm-hmm. And there were some questions, you know, leading up to the draft of like, okay, does he have the physical ability? Is he big enough? Is his arm strong enough? Everything like that. I'm sorry. Thanksgiving week and you're throwing go balls to Pickens at the number one spot when you're going trips to the field, you're throwing far hash go balls to number one where the corner, like they're in two man and the corner literally, or not the corner, the safety literally is not expanding that far because he doesn't believe that you're going to throw that ball. And Pickens says, all right, bet I'm going to throw that ball. And he drops a fucking seed, EJ. Down the boundary. It's mm-hmm. perfect. It's far ash. He steps up. He just fucking rips it. And it bounces off Pickens' hands. And I get it. That would have changed the game. And maybe they would have won. Who knows? But just the fact that he made the throw and it was perfect and he put on film that he can do that, I guarantee you defenses are going to play him differently now. Like if they're in two man, those safeties are going to expand. Because they're going to be like, oh my God, he can actually do that. He can do the Mahomes throw. He can do the Herbert throw. Is it the same in terms of velocity? No, but it's getting there and it's accurate and he's willing to do it. That game was scary. That game was scary. And I think the Steelers got something here. They didn't win, but I think they got more confidence in their quarterback.
For me, that throw was the cherry on top, but the real healthy dessert serving, the sort of main course stuff was game management in terms of not being a game manager. That's always a backhanded compliment when you're talking about quarterbacks. That's not what I'm saying here. His management of game situations as the quarterback was better. It improved, and the way you saw that demonstrated physically a bunch of times was his movement within the pocket. We all knew that Kenny Pickett could scramble, and he had really good mobility. It was actually one of the things when I watched his tape that surprised me. I was like, man, he's not just mobile. He's really mobile. Like, he can get out of the pocket in a hurry and pick up yards. It wasn't that. It was the subtle movement to stay within the pocket and then make a play. And he did it a lot yesterday. You could see the growth. You could see the development. You could see that maturation of his process starting to slow down and marry with those physical gifts and using them to stay within the offense, not just kind of run off or run into pressure, but move very quickly away from pressure, reset, and make one of those good throws because he made a bunch of them yesterday. You said at the top of the show, the plucky Kenny Pickett, right? He was plucky. He kept the thorn in the side of the Bengals until late in the game. They were in this till, you know, they were onside kicking with not very much time to go. They had a shot at this, and it was because of the way Kenny Pickett played, not in spite of the way Kenny Pickett played, which is the story we're going to talk about with another young quarterback coming up. But it was really nice to see the development, and I, too, came away with the same feeling of, yeah, if they want to roll into next year with Kenny Pickett as their guy, the team believes he can make those throws. He's starting to make less of those bad decisions that cost them, which is the natural process for a rookie going through his first season. I'm interested in a good way to see what year two looks like for Pickett in Pittsburgh.
You get him a new offensive coordinator, not named Matt Canada. You invest more in the offensive line. I already like the receiving core. You know, they got some young guys that we love, like Pickens is a dude. Deontay's great. You know, we'll see what the future holds for Calvin Austin, but the physical talent there is off the charts as well. And then you got Pat Freiermuth, who I think has shown a lot of flashes of being like their new Heath Miller. Najee, totally forgot about Najee too, but there's weapons there. So you get a new offensive coordinator. And you get a little bit more investment in the offensive line to kind of stabilize that a little bit, and you roll with Pickett. And I think this team could, not will, but could put up 28 to 30 points a game. Mm-hmm. Absolutely have the talent to do that. And I think Kenny Pickett as a trigger man can do that. won't have the same crazy, ridiculous face-melting highlights all the time, but you're going to look up and you're going to see a very accurate quarterback that can make big-time throws, that doesn't shrink under pressure, has good pocket presence. It's going to work. I really do think it's going to work. Like, everything that he's put on tape this year, none of it has been red flags like some other young quarterbacks that we're going to talk about in our next segment, Two Down. All right, EJ, Two Down, number one. Possibly the only thing grosser than shooting absinthe before noon. This is my third shot of the show, by the way. I'm a man of my word. The only thing worse than this is the Vikings pass protection. And when I first saw the score for this game, 40-3, I was filming out at SoFi, and I was like, there's no way. Like, how is this even possible? And then I get home, and it's the first game I put on, because this was after the Chiefs game. First game I put on, I was like, I need to see what's happening here. And yeah, 40-3 makes absolute sense. If you can't even let Kirk get to the top of his drop before he's getting obliterated by Micah and Armstrong and Fowler. I mean, everybody. It was an equal opportunity ass whooping. And even Christian Darrisaw, who left the game after like a little over a quarter, he only had 10 pass blocking snaps before he went out, and he still gave up 2 sacks in 10 pass block snaps. And he gave up 1 to Micah early, which was a forced fumble. And then he gave up, I think it was Dorrance, did like a speed to power into his chest and caved him in and got Kirk for the second sack. But like, he wasn't the only one. The backup that came in for him, Blake Brandel, gave up 4 pressures and 2 sacks. Ed Ingram gave up a sack. It seems like tradition at this point. Brian O'Neill was the only one who didn't give up a sack, but he still gave up 3 pressures. Garrett Bradbury gave up 5 pressures. Like, it was bad. And it wasn't just guys getting beat one-on-one. Like, they couldn't handle stunts. They couldn't handle blitzes. Like, their communication was bad. It was just horrific, and one of the worst offensive line performances I've seen from any team this entire season. And I'll tell you what, if there's any defensive front that you can't have a poor outing against, it's Dallas, because they got athletes all over the place. And once they smell blood, you're dead. You know, it's like gators swarming. And it was rough. It was hard to watch. And I got about 3 quarters into it after like the 7th sack. And I was like, there was no quarterback in the league they could have won under those circumstances. Like, it wasn't even Kirk's fault. Not that he played amazing, but what do you want him to do? So yeah. I think it was a fascinating U-turn from last week's Cowboys loss, where they gave Micah like 11 snaps as a pass rusher, something outrageous like that. They gave him a shitload more than that this week, and it paid off. He had 8 pressures and I think 2 sacks himself and that forced fumble. And just, this is how the Cowboys are supposed to play. Rush the passer, run the ball with Pollard, let Dak make a couple nice throws a game. And man, they'd be hard to beat with that formula.
Yeah, you came out saying, what happened? Because you were busy filming, and I retweeted that and said, look, Micah threw a brick through their windshield on the first drive, and they never recovered. Like, literally first drive, he gets around Darrisaw, fumble, Cowboys recover. I was at the bar for this one. Bunch of Cowboys fans have started showing up at the bar. They are loud. And I was like, oh, something happened. Oh, look at that. We're not even 2 minutes into this game, and the Vikings pass protection looks just like your face. No, and they never recovered. You would hope with a team with this much talent in terms of the Vikings could find their footing. They never did. And this was the perfect convergence of two teams coming together from very disparate situations last week. Cowboys, bad loss, didn't let Micah rush last week. Vikings, really good win over the Bills, coming in riding high. Cowboys turn the switch back to, you know, Micah to obliterate on the pass rush, and the Vikings come in feeling all great. They get their balloon popped on the first drive, and the Cowboys just curb stomped them from there on out. It was an avalanche that they couldn't stop. And my feeling coming out of this game is that the Vikings, when I went back and look at their record, they really feel like sort of paper tigers in the NFC. I looked at their wins. They beat the Packers early in the year, who couldn't get it together. They beat the Lions, who always give up a bunch of points, and the Vikings are really good at one thing this year, and that's scoring a bunch of points. The Saints, obviously, hadn't found their footing. The Bears before the big offensive streak. The Dolphins, okay, I'll give you the Dolphins. Cardinals, same thing. Commanders, mm-mm. And Bills in overtime. So they basically have two quality wins, and they're over the powers in the AFC East. Their losses are the Eagles and the Cowboys. So it really feels like when they come up in the playoffs against any of the power teams from the NFC, they're not going to be able to compete. Because if you can't polish off the Eagles and you get smashed by the Cowboys like this, it's going to be one of those sort of one-and-done things that Vikings fans have come to really hate. Oh, we made the playoffs. Oh, we got mashed by 20. Oh, that's not great. So they can, the Vikings, this is, beat any team on any given day with all that talent, with Justin Jefferson and Kirk gets hot and Dalvin and, you know, the defense plays average. Hell, they beat the Bills in overtime. I get it. Bills certainly
they needed some crazy shit to happen for it to happen, but they
I understand, but they did do it, and that's a sort of on any given Sunday. But would you bet them against a power team in the NFC right now? And my answer is hell no. I wouldn't put any money against them if you're going up against the Titans of the NFC. So their record looks amazing. And their reality come the playoffs, I don't think will be near as amazing.
It's just all about matchups to me. And I think, you know, looking at the Vikings offensive line as a whole, they kind of hung their hat on their two tackles. They're like, okay, the interior sucks, but hey, we got O'Neal that can handle one-on-ones. We got Darisaw that can handle one-on-ones. We think we can just do 3-on-2 up front. And if they're sending a fifth, we'll keep the running back or the tight end in, something like that. And so, like, as long as our tackles can handle one-on-ones, everybody else can get help and we'll be all right. When they go up against a defensive line with equal edge talent, I would say, like, say, Micah versus Darisaw or, you know, Dorrance converting speed to power. Like, if you're going up against guys that can match talent for talent, where the one-on-ones are all of a sudden shakier than they would be against most other teams, now your advantage is gone. And Kirk is just kind of a sitting duck. He's not really mobile enough to get out of a lot of that kind of stuff. So I think against the Eagles, who, when they're healthy, have great defensive line talent, both at the edges and on the interior. Hopefully Jordan Davis comes back soon. And then, you know, Dallas might be one of, if not the most talented defensive front in the league. When you have to go up, quote-unquote, strength versus strength, I don't necessarily think their strength is strong enough to go up against the stronger defensive lines in the NFC. And I think, you know, kind of looking ahead to the playoff picture, I mean, God, just looking at the NFC playoffs right now, you got the Eagles are still going to be in it. You got the Cowboys are still going to be in it. The 49ers, when they're healthy, they have a hellacious defensive line. I would say the Seahawks defensive line is also playing a lot better. Like, this could low-key be kind of an issue for them in January, especially if their tackles are having an off day. Like, they don't really have any other card to play here. So it's concerning. It's not a death knell. It's not a death knell for them because they're still a very talented team. You got Dalvin, you got Jefferson, you know, Kirk is playing better this year. They got some really nice defensive line talent. Like, they're still going to be in it. I just think that there are matchups that they don't handle well, and Dallas is absolutely one of them.
Yeah, we found that out yesterday. No, I low-key love Death Nail. Death Nail is great. I'm going to use that. no, they got smashed, and it has to be concerning if you're a Vikings fan, because you're looking at the Sterling record, and you're riding high. You got a new coach. The offense is working like you hoped it would. Defense has been, for the most part, holding on. Powered you to, again, a very good record. And you got to be looking down the road now, or start looking down the road now. Most people do. It's that turn of the calendar, right? We get to Thanksgiving and, okay, who's for real? Who's a contender? Who's a pretender? Who's going to end up there in the dance at the end? Who's going to have a chair? And are you going to have more than a chair? Like, you need a chair and a chance, right? Are you going to have a chance? And it really does depend on who they end up squaring off against. And there are definitely teams that should scare the Vikings right now because they've seen a couple of them and they haven't fared well in those two games.
But one of the teams that should scare them is the next one we're going to talk about, the Jets, because they played them on December 4th. And if the Cowboys' defensive line gave them this much problem, the Jets might actually kill Kirk. I'm a little bit worried for his safety because the Jets are even better than Dallas is. And I don't think they got a prayer to block the Jets if that's the kind of performance they're putting up against Dallas. But the Jets have their own problems themselves, which is two down number two, Zach Wilson.
This one is primary for them, and it is a problem. We have been withholding judgment and saying, hey, we saw some good things, we saw some bad things, we're gonna wait and see. The end of this season is really when we were gonna pass judgment and say, this is what we think the Jets should do. Much like we just said with Kenny Pickett and the Steelers, either they have something or they don't. And it is really starting to look like the Jets don't. And that is a major issue. So against New England, Zach Wilson, 9 for 22 for 77 yards. Those are not his stats for the half. That's the whole game. No touchdowns. For the season, 55.6 completion, 1,279 yards, 4 TDs, and more interceptions than touchdowns, and a 72.6 rating.
Gross.
Joe Flacco still leads the Jets in touchdowns with 5, having played in 3 games.
So that's like the worst stat I've ever seen.
Zach Wilson has 4 in 7 games.
Oh, God.
So the production on the field is one thing, but he is not a rookie. He played a decent amount in his rookie season. Full rookie season? No. But he played a decent amount in his rookie season, enough to get a lot of those rookie struggles out from under his belt, to see a bunch of different defenses, to learn some things and kind of take the rough edges off. His completion percentage as a rookie was 55.6. His completion percentage as a sophomore in the NFL, 55.6. Not great.
No.
So that's, you're not going to earn any wins against anyone playing like that. That's just not enough offense. The Jets offense for the second half earned 2.7 inches worth of progress per snap.
What?
The second half offensive production for the Jets yesterday was 2.7 inches per snap.
Is that real?
That's 100% real.
I am legitimately stuck. That might be, okay.
It's real, real bad.
I think my brain just melted. That yep. might be the worst second half in NFL history then. It's, like, legitimately.
It's really, really bad. And you could say a little bit last year, but not so much this year, oh, well, Zach Wilson, he's getting pressure. He's not. He's been sacked 15 times. Justin Fields has been sacked 40.
Ugh.
40. So it's Jesus. Not that he's not getting time. That's not the thing. So the performance issue alone on the field, the production that we've talked about, that puts the Jets by itself in a huge quandary. We invested. This is a guy we went and got. The rest of our team is ready. The Jets are not like a lot of other young, improving teams where they still need to surround the quarterback with talent. The quarterback is surrounded with talent, both on the offense and the defense is, as you alluded to at the top, really well balanced, formidable. This is a roster that's ready to go right now, and they don't have anything powering their offense. The windows in the NFL are really small. You can't hold a core that talented together for very long. You've got a couple of years before contracts start aging out. You're going to have to pay people and start sort of replenishing the cupboard. So they don't have time to sort of go, oh, we'll give Zach another. No, you don't. You don't have another year. On top of that, after the game yesterday, he comes out, post-game comments, reporter tees one up for him and says, do you feel like you let the defense down? This is where, as a young quarterback, you got to fall on your sword, swallow your pride, and go, yeah. Did you see my performance out there? It was junk. They played great. They've been playing great all year. I screwed it up. Zach Wilson goes 180 degrees the other way and says, no, I don't feel like I let him down. You can't do that as a quarterback. I don't care if you think it's true or not. I don't care if you think it's your fault or not. In this case, it is his fault.
Yeah.
But regardless of that, yeah, like obviously with what we've laid out here, but either way, as the quarterback of a team, you are not just the guy pulling the trigger on offense. You are the leader of that team, presumably. And if you say things like, no, it's not going to go over really well in the locker room. It is going to be divisive. We're already starting to see those cracks show up on social media. Robert Saleh called the offense out as bullshit in his post-game conference.
Yikes.
Like, this is not a stable platform for Zach to be standing on and casting aspersions at other parts of the team. He's the issue, largely, and he stands up there and says no. That combined with his performance is hugely troubling. Like, the Jets have a massive problem. They have a wildfire right now, and they need to figure out what to do about it, because the ancient guy on their roster, Joe Flacco, is outperforming the guy that was supposed to lead this franchise to the promised land. Joe Douglas has done an amazing job gathering personnel. We talked about their draft as one of our top three drafts in the NFL this year. This team is primed. They've ripped off a couple of wins. They've looked like they arrived, and then your quarterback comes out and lays an egg and says, it's not my fault, on top of that. This is bad.
If I am Robert Saleh, I am starting Mike White this week against the Bears. And it's not just the fact that Zach Wilson has played terribly, which he has. Objectively, you can go to the film and see him sailing balls wide open, you know, over the middle to a receiver that's like 4 yards of separation, and he's throwing it 3 yards high, and Devin McCourty is so surprised by that, he drops the easiest pick of his life. It's not just the fact that Wilson's been terrible. It's the fact that if he can be terrible and then go in front of the media and say, it's not my fault, that shows a complete lack of accountability to the point where the locker room will turn on Robert Saleh if he doesn't hold Zach Wilson accountable. And he can hold Zach Wilson accountable by sitting him for Mike White. Because even if Wilson doesn't think it's his fault, spoiler alert, it is his fault, even if Wilson doesn't think it's his fault, the rest of the team does. You got Sauce Gardner out here liking tweets that are anti-Zach Wilson. Like, the defense knows they did their job, and they know their quarterback didn't. So you cannot allow him to avoid accountability. And if he's not willing to take accountability, you have to force him to take accountability by being on the bench. So start Mike White, give the defense at least some confidence that you have their back, and prevent a complete locker room mutiny. Zach Wilson is not worth losing the locker room. And you have one chance to keep the locker room by playing Mike White.
And it's got to happen right now. And that announcement should come today. We're recording this on a Monday. Robert Saleh should come out and say, Mike White is our starter next week. We're going to ride with him throughout the game. And if people ask him why, he should tell them why.
Yeah.
He should say, because I need the quarterback of the New York Jets to take accountability for how this team performs on offense. And that should be it. It should be a one-sentence statement. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. See you tomorrow or whenever his next availability is. Like, he should just drop the hammer, leave, and say, we're moving on. You know, not saying we can't come back. I'm not getting into any of that. Not getting into our draft plans. Like, next week it's Mike White. It's because I need the quarterback to be accountable. Bam, done, out.
And guess what? If he plays Mike White and they beat the Bears, week after that, play him against the Vikings.
Yeah.
Like, you're 7-3, and you're trying to stay alive in a very competitive AFC East. You can't afford to throw this away for a guy who's thrown 4 touchdowns in 7 games. Like, your defense is playing out of its fucking mind. You cannot waste this for Zach Wilson. Like, it's one thing, like, the Broncos are wasting their defense on Russell Wilson because they paid him a gazillion dollars and a whole bunch of picks. You didn't invest that much into Zach Wilson. So, cut bait if you need to. It's not that hard to me to make that decision.
And it's not just the defense. The offense is too. Garrett Wilson came out and said, you know, we need people to be basically accountable in their habits and, you know, have the right behaviors. And it was a pretty veiled statement, but it's pretty obvious where it's pointing at this point. He called out some of the coaches as well. it's not a good situation. You need to stamp this kind of thing out. It is like a wildfire in the building right now. They need to put it out with a wet blanket right now and move on, because this is a good football team. It's a good football team on the roster. It's a good football team on the field. And they have a good shot. They are well positioned to play themselves into playoff contention this year and make some noise. Like, they are a good enough team to do that. And this could bump them off that track. And they don't have that kind of leeway. They need to strike while the iron is hot. And if that means removing Zach Wilson from the equation for either a week or a while, they need to do that.
All right, let's get to something a little bit more palatable, literally and figuratively. One fun.
One fun for this week. We're going to go into some looks at the division and the balance of powers between the conferences. We're going to look at wins by division. It's about that time in the calendar. The leaves have come down now. The snow's piled up in Buffalo. Who's going to be in playoff contention? Who has a shot? And who doesn't? We've been talking about that throughout the podcast, but I really wanted to take a look by conference and then broken down by division. Which are the strongest divisions and which are the weakest? Because we had our predictions in the offseason about how this was going to go, and the reality is starting to take shape now that we're at Thanksgiving. So for the AFC, we're going to go top to bottom. The East, 26 wins. The West, 19 wins. The North, also 19 wins. And the South, 15 wins, which is the lowest in all of football. Yikes. So AFC South, not doing great. AFC East, kicking right along. That's the division we were just talking about with the Jets. 26 wins. Second only to the NFC East. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about all the power is in the East. It's still there. The NFC East, 29 wins, just like we all had it preseason, right? Not quite. Most powerful division in football right now is the NFC East with 29 wins. The NFC West has 18. The NFC North has 19. And the NFC South has 17. So I would say parity in the NFC besides the East at 29. That's the juggernaut. And the AFC East, 26 wins. The West and the North at tied at 19, and then the South bringing up the rear for the entire league at 15. You can see the balance of power still resides in the East. We had said all offseason long that AFC West was going to be the juggernaut, the big robot-killing division that was going to be knocking each other off all season. Yeah, well, not so much. There's Kansas City and the rest of them. But power in the East is a thing. It's not going away anytime soon. And it kind of muddies up the playoff picture, because literally the fourth team in the NFC East has 6 wins, and there are division leaders like the Buccaneers who have 5.
The fact that, once again, there's another division that will put a team in the playoffs at under 500 to be the sacrificial lamb. It does seem like this happens with the NFC South more than most divisions, by the way. I think it's happened like 3 times in the last decade that that division's done this. I think that this spread in terms of like hyper-dominant divisions and then ultra-terabad divisions is going to put a new spotlight on how we seed things in the playoffs, because, I mean, Tampa will be a draw in the playoffs because of Tom Brady and everything like that, but let's say they completely collapsed and the Falcons won the division at like 9-8 or 8-9 even, because anything's possible at this point. Does anybody really want to watch like an 8-9 or 9-8 Falcons team get absolutely obliterated by a 2-seed Cowboys in the first round? Like, does that seem like appetizing January football to people? I don't know if it does to me. And I think that as long as this keeps happening, especially with a 17-game season and 7 seeds in the playoffs, I think that there will be a groundswell of support for maybe let's not reward bad divisions with a playoff spot when every team in them is bad. Like, it's one thing for the Titans. Like, the Titans are 7-3 in the AFC South, and the AFC South is horrible. But at least the Titans are a good team. And so they will make the playoffs on their own merit. But I think doing away with the whole, like, if you win the division, you're automatically in, even if you're a bad football team. I think doing away with that and allowing good teams to just fight it out for seeds regardless of the division they're in, I think that might actually get strong consideration sooner rather than later. Because it just feels weird to me that right now the Cowboys, who obliterated the Vikings that are 8-2, the Cowboys are 7-3, and the Vikings are a 2-seed and the Cowboys are a 5-seed, just because of how things work, because the Eagles are 9-1. When the Cowboys are, if you put them up against the Seahawks right now, they'd probably beat them. Put them up against the Buccaneers right now, they'd probably beat them. And yet both of them are seated higher because of just the nature of how playoffs are structured. And I get the sense that if we see another NFC South team go to the wood chipper in January for like the third time in the last decade, there will be enough support for people to say, do we really have to do it this way?
I think getting in is fine for divisional winners. I think seeding should be purely on record. So you can let the Bucs in at, you know, 9-8 or 8-9 or the Falcons or whoever else, but they're a wild card team. Right?
I would agree. I would see that as a nice happy medium.
Right.
Because so then at least you don't have to have the Cowboys go on the road.
Right.
You know.
And, you know, every division games are still important, and playing well within your division and winning your division guarantees you get into the playoffs, but it doesn't guarantee you a comfy seat once you get there. If you barely cracked 500, happen to win your very poor division with that record, you could still be a wild card because right now, you know, somebody in the NFC East, you know, there's not a team with less than 6 wins in the NFC East right now. Like the lowest team has 6 wins and the highest team in the NFC South has 5. You know, and there are other disparities. The Vikings, we talked about, they're an 8-win team. They have a 4-game lead in the NFC North right now because the Packers are faltering or faltered so badly at the beginning of the year. They basically could sew it up within a week or two. Like they could be the division winners. And that's fine. They have a great record. They get a division win, they should be a top-seeded team based, again, on their record. But if you limp into the playoffs, you're not getting a first-round bye for sure. You're basically a wild-card team. You're going to have to go on the road. And I think that's fine.
Yeah, I don't know. There's just it just irks me. I've never really liked punishing teams for, even if they're better than everybody else, coming second in a dominant division to another dominant team. I don't know. It takes away the spirit of meritocracy in the NFL, which I think the NFL always strives for, which is you earn what you keep, you eat what you kill. This structure kind of goes away from that, so I'd like to see it go away. All right, last segment, favorite segment, or second to last segment, I should say, but still our favorite segment, bootleg shot of the week. Okay.
More cork sounds.
I'm just going to keep pulling this cork.
That's
it. Because it sounds so great.
You got some.
This is my last shot of the episode. I have 3 down, 1 to go for bootleg shot of the week. And we are toasting Alandon Roberts of Miami Dolphins, right?
Yes, indeed.
My brain only half works at this point, EJ. I hope you can understand. Yeah,
I can pick up the slack here. Alandon Roberts of the Miami Dolphins hitting Nick Chubb, using the term we coined this summer, doing linebackery things to Nick Chubb, and they were very linebackery things. Not many linebackers can stand up Nick Chubb, stop his momentum, turn him 90 degrees, and put him on his back. But Alandon Roberts, you accomplished the feat, so we're going to do shots of absinthe. I'm not sure how that's connected, but we said we would, so here we go. Here's to you, Alandon Roberts.
It never gets easier.
Oh, nope. Sure doesn't.
Oh, God, okay. I need to hide this in a faraway place.
We're going to turn this to a more positive bent in just a second.
I'm literally tearing up, dude. It's like poison.
It's,
I swear to God.
It's rugged. It is not not an easy thing to do. So, an easier thing to do is go through our nominees for Shot of the Week for this week. You want me to lead that one?
Bro, I'm like half functional right now. It's all you.
Okay. No worries. Happy to do it. First one we're going to look into is Micah Parsons leading off the Cowboys' destruction of the Vikings in the very first drive with a shot for a forced fumble. We talked about that one throughout the game. Really set the tone for this one. The Cowboys end up pretty much curb stomping the Vikings after that. Second one we've got is Jordan Whitehead laying the wood. Jordan Whitehead was one of my favorite free agent additions this offseason. Thought that he was going to perform really well in that defense. This is visual evidence of him doing exactly that. Our third one is Matt Milano of the Bills getting a big sack in the game versus the Browns. Matt Milano just sort of adding to his, at this point, all underrated team cred with a big play and a big game on the road that the Bills really needed to win. And I say on the road because it was in Detroit, not Buffalo, thanks to the 77 inches of snow at Orchard Park the last time I heard. And a special holiday inclusion. This one is a security guard at a college game, absolutely cleaning house on a fan that decided it was a good idea to run down the sidelines. I'd bet that security guard probably played college football by the look of the angle he took and the absolute destruction he laid out on the hit. We figured we'd have something a little bit fun for Thanksgiving, so we tossed this one in. And speaking of fun things for Thanksgiving, we're going to make a $200 donation to Northwest Harvest this holiday season. They help put food on families' tables all over the Northwest. You too can chip in if you want to do something a little more productive than buying us shots of absinthe this holiday. We'll put a link in the description to Northwest Harvest. Certainly give if you can. Great cause. I've been up there packaging food before. Great organization. Really necessary this time of year. So we'd love your support there because we can handle shots of absinthe, but we don't want to take that many, and we'd rather see that money put towards good use, putting food on families' tables.
I can't feel my mouth.
I'm starting to lose feeling in mine, but I said I was going to do two, and as I am a man of my word, I will do my second one to start off the watch list. So why don't you just sit there and recover?
I can do it. I'm good. I'm good. I went to college, EJ. I'm a trooper.
Oh, so did I, but I didn't do this in college. So here's number two for all you sickos on the Thursday night live stream.
When I went to college, we had Old Four Loko, okay? Old Four Loko was weaponized. This is nothing. I mean, it's something,
well,
but it's not that.
This is, I was going to say, this is not nothing, it's something, but I'm going to stack the second one right on top of the first one because I don't want to give my system any time to react.
All right, I'll try to get through watch list here. Bills-Lions Thanksgiving, intriguing game. Lions are on a roll. Bills had a little bit of a slide, but bounced back against a equally beleaguered Browns team. The Josh Allen elbow injury continues to be a storyline. We're not 100% sure how much it's affecting him right now, but if you look at some of the what should have been easy throws last week that he was not hitting, it was very evident that the UCL is at least hampering him a little bit. Not to mention, I think the Lions defense has really stepped up over the last 3 weeks. They fired Aubrey Pleasant on Halloween, who was their DB coach, and they promoted their safeties coach to be their new DB coach, and they've only allowed 19 points per game over that stretch, which isn't, like, amazing, but it's definitely not historically awful like they were on pace to be before. So you combine a clearly not 100% Josh Allen with a not even resurgent, but just not totally ass Lions defense, and I think we have the makings for a very interesting Thanksgiving game there. We got Bengals-Titans also this week, and Bengals-Titans, I think, should be a playoff preview. I would imagine both of these teams are going to be in January, and depending on how the seeding goes, we might actually see them play against each other in January, which would be a rematch of last year's playoff matchup, which was a nail-biter to the very end, and it took a crazy, crazy play from Ja'Marr Chase and Joe Burrow to send them to the Super Bowl from that one. So very, very good matchup between two teams. Obviously, both of them are semi-banged up, but they're still incredibly talented and still incredibly dangerous. You got Ravens-Jags, which theoretically should be a Ravens win, but I can't really figure out Baltimore this year. They're very up and down, very inconsistent. One week they look like they could compete with like the top dogs in the conference. The next week they are hanging on for dear life against Carolina. So it's tough for me to figure them out. Hopefully they walk in to this game against Jacksonville and take care of business and prove that, you know, they can keep pace in the North and, you know, kind of keep doing what they're doing. Very, very hard team to figure out. One of the hardest to figure out, I would say, in the entire AFC, because you never really know what you're going to get from them. And then our oddly fascinated game of the week, Saints 49ers. 49ers are a team that is much more talented than their record would suggest, but they are also extraordinarily hurt this year. I think they've actually been hurt since I was in training camp in August. Like, when I was there, like, literally their top three corners were already banged up, and we were in the middle of preseason. So this team has never been healthy throughout the year, and they're still well-positioned for a playoff run. Will they be able to catch Seattle and take over the division and host a playoff game? We'll see, but winning this one would go a long way towards helping them do that. If they lose this one, I don't know if they'll be able to catch Seattle. It'll be much tougher for them to do. But either way, very intriguing matchups on both sides of the ball. And the 49ers, theoretically, in the back half of the year, could maybe go on a little bit of run if they get healthier. CEJ, I'm functional-ish.
It's highly impressive. Not Four Loko impressive, but still highly impressive. So, short week this week, since hopefully everyone will be enjoying Thanksgiving. We are not doing a stream on Thursday, as we said last week that we would not be. We'll be returning to the regularly scheduled program on Thursday Night Football for Bootleg next week. But we will be back. We'll be back early next week with a fresh podcast.
Couple more minutes. We just got to get through it.
Gotta go.
Then we can go like eat bagels and popcorn and everything else to soak up the evil.
Maybe take a nap, because those are not easy shots to do. I'm not sure why you ever took the first one during the draft live stream, but it's caused a nasty ripple effect that we're going to have to turn around. We need to put out there in the universe that really what people should pay for is like shots of Buffalo Trace, because I could get behind that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I have to do Eagle Rare this week.
Oh, no.
Whatever will I do? What do you got coming on? Are you doing Bears Over Bears this week?
We're going to try and squeeze in one. We may not. Again, my other podcast partner, JB, is also traveling for the holidays. Even though he just got back from the West Coast, he's going to go see family. So I think we're going to be out on that one. But if we can squeeze one in, we'll do it. Everybody's going to be enjoying food, family, fun, football on Thursday. So content will be a little bit down for the last half of the week. But again, we'll be back bright and squirrely next week with another recap episode.
I have a film room coming out on Tua. Shooting for Wednesday morning.
We're trying to be nice to our editors, too. We want them to be able to enjoy food, family, fun, and if they like, football, because we give them plenty of football exposure, they might want to break from that. We should thank our executive producers and move ourselves along.
Yes, Murat, Consti, Caden, Andrew, Taylor, and Liam, all six of you guys. We cannot thank you enough. Everything you've done for the show has been amazing. Everything you've done for the live streams has been amazing. We love all of you. Everybody, if you're still here after however long this episode's been, we appreciate you. Again, no live stream this Thursday, but we'll have another podcast coming out next Wednesday or so to recap all of the Thanksgiving week games. And until then, have a happy holidays, and we'll see you soon.
Take care.
We'll be right back.